Good morning. My name is Yoav Gilad. I'm really happy being here. I'm happy to be here, and so far I've had a great time. Unfortunately, I'm only here for a short stay. I am not a theoretical population geneticist. Might call me a genomicist, maybe. My lab actually generates data, high throughput data, and we try to make sense of it. When I was a graduate student, I once heard Peter Donnelly saying that population genetics used to be a lot more fun before people started generating data. And then subsequently, Marty Kreisman and Chang Yu in Chicago told me that if you do generate data, you might as well work in a model organism that where it makes sense, the data makes sense. And I do generate data, and I don't work in model organisms. And this stems from my interest. I'm interested in traits that are specific to human and the development of these traits and the evolution of these traits. I'm also interested in human disease, so I think this is very relevant. But I think we acknowledge a lot of difficulties when we work with humans and primates, and I'll try to describe some of them today and hopefully describe what we think are signatures that are robust enough so that we can actually make sense of them. And the since we never get to the end of talks in this forum, I thought I'll give credit where credit is due. I'm actually not talking about my own work. It's all the students and the postdocs, and you know very well. And I just wanted to mention Russ and Ron, who are the two students. Ron is going to graduate next year, and he's going to be a wonderful postdoc candidate for some lab. And then Paula and Adrian that actually left the lab are also responsible for a lot of the data I will talk about. We have a lot of statistical collaborators and theoretical population geneticists that actually help us make sense of the data, and they're responsible for a lot of the insight that I will describe. And I guess I'll start the story by pointing out two papers that are classic papers in biology, and just in case some of you are not biologists, perhaps that would make sense to start from this. The first is the Breeden and Davidson paper in the early 70s. There was a series of papers where Breeden and Davidson pointed out that there's a lot of repetitive DNA out there, a lot of DNA with very little, seemingly very little information content, and they suspected that this DNA have some role in gene regulation, and that gene regulation is somehow very important. And for the human genetic community, King and Wilson brought it home in 1975, which, by the way, was the year I was born. So I was not part of that insight. That perhaps the vast phenotypic difference between human and chimpanzees cannot be explained by the relatively few differences in structure of proteins that we can observe. But maybe gene regulatory differences are responsible for the majority of the phenotypic differences. And since then, I think this hypothesis became nearly a consensus as an idea, but I think we still have very few examples where we actually know about regulatory adaptations, in particular in primates. I think we have more and more examples of that in other organisms. And when we talk about regulatory adaptations, it's a very general field. You can have changes in regulation in many places. This is just a kind of a picture of the central dogma with different, in kind of green, I pointed out different places where you might interfere with regulation or change regulation. This is only a partial list. We know of more small RNAs and different types of RNAs. Of course, many, many, many interactions between proteins and then feedback between proteins or in different places in this dogma. And we really haven't started exploring variability within species or between species, almost any of these checkpoints. We really, most of us, not all of us, but most of us really focus on steady state levels of messenger RNA because the technology allows us to study this more easily than other levels of variation. Even this, by the way, is a stretch. We don't really study steady state levels of messenger RNA most of the time. we study a snapshot of the RNA in the cell at a given time. And compared to the more complicated picture of all the possible places you might interfere in regulation, I would guess it's almost surprising when you hear it the first time, or when you think about it, when you're actually performing the experiment, that this snapshot of RNA levels in the cell can tell you anything about phenotype, can be used to explain phenotypes. But we have a lot of proof of principle, and so we probably go along because it actually, in many examples, can be used as a key to explain phenotypes. And I change these examples from time to time. They keep becoming more and more beautiful. This time I'll give you two examples. One of them is this very nice work on sticklebacks. This is an evolutionary story. This is an adaptation of a shift to a different geographical area of this population. This new population was under less severe predation pressure, and so they lost their kind of armor, the pelvis, and the change, the genetic change, was actually a change in gene expression level. That was the way it was tracked down, all the way down to a mutation in a promoter of a gene that changed the gene expression level. And then the classic example from the work on Drosophila pigmentation, Sean Carroll's work. This is actually, I think, a picture from his book. All these different beautiful patterns result from changes in cis regulatory elements that result in a change of steady state levels of messenger RNA in the cells. There are many other examples. One that I really like is the Darwin finches in the Galapagos. The different beak morphologies are actually the result of a change in gene expression level of one gene, BMP4. And so what about primates? This is I think where my lab and of course others come in. We would like to get examples like that in primates. We would like to start understanding the relative role of gene regulatory evolution, and in particular currently messenger RNA evolution, in primate phenotypes. And of course the challenges are slightly different than the ones one is facing when one works with model organisms in particular, but even with other natural populations of non-primate organisms in general. And the major problem is that we often cannot get tissues. We obviously cannot and do not want to perform experiments on primates and on humans. So tissue availability is pretty much what you can get. You cannot stage the tissues. You can't choose the tissues. You can't control the environment. And you cannot perform a lot of experiments that will inform you about parameters that are of great interest, because most of your models require some knowledge about these parameters. For example, the mutational, the input rate of mutational variants, or generation time, or the split time. These are not constructed populations. And so these difficulties limit the amount of inference we can make from the data. And I will try in this talk to distinguish between what we can say and what we can't say, and point out the robust signatures that we, I think, trust even in the face of all these difficulties. And so here's what I'll talk about. I'll talk about interprimate comparison of gene expression, which is a general study. This is what I typically call the fishing expedition part of the experiments in our lab, where we really take a genomic view. Then I'll talk about focusing on a couple of leads, or an example of what we do in the lab when we focus on a couple of leads, where we actually try to connect the regulatory change that we believe underwent some natural selection or evolved under natural selection to an actual phenotype that may be different between humans and our close evolutionary relatives. And finally, I'll tell you about our methodologies and some results on looking at actual differences in entire regulatory pathways between the species. Now, what's not on this outline, and that depends on how much time we have, we performed, it's completely unrelated, we performed some technical study using Solexa sequencing to look at RNA. Everything I'm going to tell you will be microarray technology. Now, us, my lab, and many others are moving to work with Solexa technology for gene expression, and I talked to several of you, and some of you expressed some interest in hearing about it, so I stuck it at the end of the talk. If we'll have time, I'm happy to go over it. If you don't have time, well, I guess we can do that later on individually or in other form. So these are the species I'll be talking about today. Humans, of course, chimpanzees, and rhesus macaque. We work with chimpanzees because these are our closest evolutionary relatives, and we want to understand what happens in the human lineage specifically and exclusively. So we need the chimpanzees. And then we work with rhesus macaque and old-world monkey because it affords us a nice outgroup. It many times can allow us to polarize the differences we see between human and chimpanzees. Also, coincidentally, these are the only three genomes of primates that are currently at a finished level. And so, pretty much scratch what I told you before, this is why we work with these species. We actually, in genomics, can't work right now with species that don't have full sequence. But of course, it's actually interconnected. These are the reasons they started sequencing these animals in the first place. We work with the microarray technology, yes? So we're talking about 25 million years ago, the common ancestor of macaque and human and chimpanzee. And the divergence rates are about 1% genome-wide between human and chimpanzee, and about 4.5% between rhesus and either species. And at the coding region level, it's about 0.6% and about 3%. The technology we work with are microarrays. I'm not going to introduce microarrays, so just kind of raise your hand and shout if that's the wrong judgment call. Our microarray, though, is slightly different than typical microarrays because it's a multi-species microarray. I spent several years of my young career developing this technology. I don't know that developing a technology is really appropriate. It's not a new technology, but maybe refining this technology of microarrays so we can work with it to look at gene expression differences and gene expression profiles between species. The issue was the effect of sequence divergence on hybridization intensity. It's a very intuitive issue. If you have one microarray that was designed for human, but you hybridize DNA or RNA from chimpanzee, then the sequence divergence actually attenuates the hybridization and causes apparent decrease in gene expression levels only in the chimpanzee. Actually, when you normalize, what you do is you shuffle all these differences and you get half of them to be lower and half of them to be higher, and most of your results are spurious. So we spent several years developing this technology, and I don't want to talk a lot about the difference between this and a regular microarray. Once again, this we can discuss later. The principle here is that we have orthologous probes from all the species we work with. So for every gene, and we have more than 18,000 genes on the array, we have 7 probes, and we have the same probe from the human genome, from the chimpanzee genome, and from the rhesus genome. And so when we hybridize, so it's a multi-species array, and when we hybridize RNA, the RNA hybridizes to all probes with different affinities, but we can account for differences that are due to sequence mismatches and deconfound them from differences that are due to actual abundance differences in the different types of messenger RNA because we have all these independent probes on the microarray. So in summary, this microarray allows one to look at gene expression differences between species without any confounding effects of sequence divergence on hybridization intensity. And this is the study design. This is kind of work in progress, so we continue to add tissues here. But from each tissue, we have six different tissue samples from human, chimpanzee, and rhesus macaques, and we perform 2 technical replicates to be able to estimate some technical variance and also to have some quality controls and be able to not rely on outliers, but directly figure out whether a hybridization worked or not. This is actually probably an important point. In most microarrays, most genomic investigations, although they're really high throughput, they have a lot of data over the entire genome. Most of them actually use very small sample sizes. And so the task of identifying outliers and the justification one needs in order to throw away a sample is always unclear. It's always a difficult decision. And I think the moment you have another technical replicate, even if only 2 technical replicates are not sufficient to estimate well the technical variance, they're extremely helpful in immediately deciding that you have a failed hybridization. You don't need to rely on outlier identification. You can just throw both technical replicates, do it again, and you have a very valid reason to do so. So this is the main reason we do it. We use a lot of quality control. I think a lot of the, again, coming from an empirical lab and graduating in an empirical lab, I heard a lot of mistrust about microarrays, a lot of talks, papers, conclude that microarray data is a great way to start, but it's not really reliable and not very replicable. And we humbly disagree. We think that it's true there are a lot of problems with these arrays, there are a lot of problems, there are a lot of variance that is introduced in the protocols, but I think there's a way to make sure your data is of high quality enough. And if you do that, and if you only retain data like that, and if you strive to only work with data like that, then it's actually very replicable. And I will point out during this talk a couple of patterns and results that we actually saw when we first introduced this technology and worked on a completely different platform with completely different individual samples, and we still saw the same gene to be differentially expressed. And so we perform a lot of quality controls, and I will not go through them in detail. What is interesting, what is very important to us, is that there are no systematic differences between tissues. This is being expressed here, where each color shows the histogram of intensities from one tissue, and we have 18 samples per tissue, and there's really, after normalization, no bias towards one tissue, and then there's no bias towards a particular species. And we wanted to see, for example, that all the rhesus samples have slightly reduced intensity. That's reassuring. The rhesus samples are the furthest in the tree. They are suffering the most from the destabilization intensity attenuation that I mentioned because of divergence, and we want to see that they have slightly reduced intensity. So this makes sense to us.
So is it necessarily that you expected the three tissues in the exact same distribution of mRNA concentrations? Wouldn't it be possible that one tissue is very diverse? And when you talk to people that look at tissues across humans, they say, well, you know, the number of different transcripts you get in brain is much bigger than the liver, right? So wouldn't you then expect different distributions for liver and other tissues?
That's a good question. This is actually data post-normalization. And normalization, we normalize when we make the assumption that most genes are not differentially expressed. When this is not the case, when the majority of genes are differentially expressed, and when they're differentially expressed in a way that is not symmetric in terms of what's up and what's down, we can't even normalize the data. Whether this assumption is reasonable or not, I guess is a topic that is not debated much, I think, because it's circular. We can't really analyze microarrays without normalizing them. It's very difficult for us to do that. We started doing this, and the result made sense, and I don't know of many papers that revisited this. I think in the case of the tissues we work with, the liver, the kidney, the heart, and the testis, and the pancreas, the lung, we have a lot of unnormalized raw data from many sources to suggest that most genes are not differentially expressed. Most genes are more or less have the same level of expression. I think you're right. If you compare particular neuron to some blood cell that expresses very few genes, this is something that you have to be concerned about before you start normalizing. And especially when you work with, for example, arrays that are focused arrays. But these are very general arrays. They are genome wide. I think this assumption is a reasonable assumption.
I just lost the thread. Most genes are not differentially expressed between tissues and humans, is that what you mean?
Yes.
Between species?
Both. Both is the case. Most genes, out of a collection of 20,000 genes, most genes are not actually differentially expressed between species or between tissues.
So what we look at here is not the absolute expression distribution, but expression relative to some reference.
Well, right now, this is actually the absolute distribution, except it's normalized. So the way we normalize it is by taking some adaptation of what's called a quant normalization. We normalize it based on a reference distribution. That reference distribution is generated using all the data, but following that adjustment, this is the absolute intensity values.
But then this is just, I mean, then you just normalize these things to have the same distribution.
Absolutely. Okay. The way you normalize them the way we normalize them allows for tissue-specific or species-specific deviations if they exist. So we don't take away those global deviations if they actually exist. They're usually technical. We don't make the assumption, we still make the assumption that most genes are differentially expressed. But we allow for global differences in expression that may result from, for example, from different processing of the tissues. For example, if all the RNA in the hearts was degraded, and we, for some reason, didn't notice that on the gels. And so all the RNAs have lower intensity, all the RNA from heart has lower intensity in our experiment, all those green lines would have been slightly lower. Our normalization would not have corrected that the way before. Similar is the case for all the rhesus macaques. All the rhesus macaques are here, and you can see they're slightly lower. And that's good for us. And we expected that. This is confirming our expectation, but we did not correct for it. This is, our normalization did not account for that. This is a sanity check. This is not purely a quality control, but this is a sanity check to see that the patterns we see from the array make sense. What you see here is a correlation of all the data from technical replicates. So this is very, very high. Then you see correlation. This is, of course, box plots of all the data that is within tissues within species, and that's slightly lower. And then we go all the way to between tissues, between species, and that correlation is the lowest. And that's what we expect. This is not about single genes, it's not about individual genes. We just expect this particular correlation structure based on many other studies, based on also intuition, the fact that replicates would be more similar than things between species. And so we were happy seeing this correlation structure just to make sure that data overall makes sense to us. And the other very important thing before I actually talk about results is to make sure that although we work with a multi-species array and we think that there's not going to be any bias towards a particular species, it was important for us to find out that this is indeed the case. A lot of the results I will tell you about will have a direction. Something happens in human more than in chimpanzees. Something happened in chimpanzee and human more than in rhesus. And we wanted to know that we're not looking globally at patterns that are biased. So what you see here is the direction of expression change in human compared to the rhesus. And so green is highly expressed compared to the rhesus, and red is lowly expressed compared to the rhesus. And this is the same for chimpanzee. And the important take-home message from this is that pretty much the same number of genes that have high expression compared to rhesus have low expression compared to rhesus. And this is just ordering these plots, which is easier to see that this is pretty much the same numbers. And this is important. This validates, first of all, our normalization, because it means, first, most genes might not be differentially expressed. Those that they are, half of them are up, half of them are down, so we can normalize it on a mean zero, and that we don't have a particular bias towards human or towards chimpanzee. For biological reason, annotational reason, technical reason, you might expect that if, for example, the annotation in the genome is wrong and is human biased, and many of these genes exist in the human genome but do not actually exist in the chimpanzee and rhesus, you might have seen a very different picture here. And this does not seem to be the case. So these are our quality controls. This is how we make sure that the data makes sense to us before we start analyzing it. And then we analyze it using the framework of linear models, taking into account a lot of the effects that we know a priori will affect the data. I'm not going to go over this in many details. I just want to point out this is, of course, what we're interested in, the expression estimate. We're running these models for each tissue. We take into account the sequence mismatch effect. The fact that we have probes from multiple species on the microarray allows us to take that effect into account explicitly. And then we take into account other probe effects, composition effects, and position effects. So remember, we have 7 probes per gene, and we want to combine them to one expression level over the gene. So this is a very similar spirit to what RMA does in affymetrics, although we here don't have a weighted average here. We just take into account that variance due to probe composition, I will call it. And then we have actual composition. It's not only the fact that human probe will bind better to the human probe and chimpanzee probe will bind better to the chimpanzee probe. The two probes are going to be slightly different because they were synthesized independently, because they have sequence differences, and so their kinetics is different, and we take that into account explicitly as well. And then, of course, we have a term for the individual variance. This is a random effect. And one of the shortcomings of this model is that we make the assumption that the individual variance is the same in all species. And it's very difficult for us to relax this assumption without running it on separate models, which would make it very difficult for us to compare gene expression differences between species. This is the one assumption we don't live with very easily. It is going to be conservative with respect to everything I'm going to tell you now, or everything I will tell you, but it's probably causing us to miss a lot of the patterns that we are interested in. So what is it that we're interested in? This is where I begin to talk about the results. So the first thing we always perform is a simple analysis of differential expression. It's informative for us when we go look afterwards at the genes that we care to study in further details between species or between tissues. And we also want to look at global patterns, such as the fact that between human or chimpanzee and rhesus macaque, we have more differentially expressed than between human and chimpanzee. That makes sense given the separation time between the species, given the phylogeny. And we are able, of course, to look at also differences between tissues, as well as between tissues and between species. So what are we doing with all this data? There are many places we go from here. We're studying differences in regulatory pathways between species by actually looking not only at individual genes, but at taking independent pathway data. When Shamil spoke yesterday, there was this discussion about whether you look at pathway or whether you look at genes independently. I agreed with that comment that was made yesterday. I think we want to start looking at pathways, and a lot of our analysis relies on prior knowledge, not only on the pathway themselves, but also on the flux in the pathways and which genes come first and which genes come later. We study differences in entire regulatory networks. The field of generating gene expression networks based on correlation of gene expression is, of course, very people discuss it at length, whether this means that they're actually a regulatory interaction or not. This is the data we have, and we follow it. We try to build networks independently for each species and look at differences and similarities. And we can also study individual processes that shape regulatory evolution based on independent data. Ask what are the covariates that associate well with changes in gene expression. And unfortunately, all this I actually won't talk today. These are studies that are in process, and these are I'm putting them out there in case this piques your interest and you want to kind of talk about these things later on.
Just going back one slide, when you say these genes are differentially expressed, what's your resolution there? Is that 10% difference in expression or twofold, or just?
That's a good question. I neglected to say we don't actually use a fold change cutoff when we look at differential expression. We use a purely statistical cutoff, and so this of course can be translated into a fold change cutoff gene by gene basis based on the variance that we estimate for each gene. But it's not uniform. Some genes have more variance. Some genes have less variance. So this is actually with a false discovery rate of 0.01%. And most of these differences are actually small. I think that 50% of these differences are smaller than about 0.5 fold.
The numbers. So you find in a number of cases that one in three genes is different between primates, right, in the same tissue.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is that the number? I mean, it seems big to me. Because, I mean, if we're talking about very small differences on the level of the sequences, then maybe it's surprising that you get the expression in such high fraction of all genes, or you don't find this surprising.
I don't know. This is subjective. I don't find it surprising, but perhaps because I've been looking at differences between tissues and species for the better part of 8 years. And I don't remember what I found surprising the first time I saw it. It's a good question in that sense, because I just saw a paper reporting a 48% difference between two closely related species. 48% of the genes were differentially expressed, and I guess I remember I read it and I thought that's too high, and that's completely because I mean, it's two species I did not study before, so my impression was just based on nothing. So yeah, I guess I'm not surprised by it, but I don't know if it's justified. This is consistent with what people are seeing when they do independent studies.
Just to put this number in the context, you have 6,000 genes differentially expressed between human and rhesus in liver. How many genes are expressed in total? For how many genes you can detect expression? So what's the denominator here?
It's a fair question, except with microarrays we can't answer it. Microarrays give the absolute intensity level on a probe and a microarray is meaningless. It might be affected by the probe, by the composition, by background. The best illustration of it is that when you look at an affymetrix array, where some of you may know, I have a perfect match probe and a mismatch probe, and the mismatch probe, the purpose of the mismatch probe is to be able to account for cross-hybridization. A lot of the time, the mismatch probes are actually have higher intensity than the perfect match probes. In fact, 30% of the values are when you do perfect match minus mismatch are typically negative. And this is because of this probe effect. It's only the relative expression levels that tell us something. That said, in a lot of our subsequent analysis, we will worry about the possibility that some of these patterns that we'll observe are because genes are not expressed. And so one way to deal with that is to choose an arbitrary cutoff that removes the lowest value, the lowest 25% values across all the arrays in the experiment, or across all the arrays for a given tissue in the experiment. This is not to say these genes are not expressed, but it's a good sanity check to see that you get the same patterns even when you remove these genes, the same biological results even when you remove these genes. If, for example, you see underrepresented or overrepresented transcription factors among genes with very uniform expression level across all your samples, one reason might be that all of these are not expressed, and so that's why you see the uniform expression level. It'd be a good idea to remove a certain proportion of lowly expressed genes and see that the results still stand, and that's what we routinely do, but we don't claim that these are not expressed, we just do that to check that the signal is robust. So what will I tell you about? These are questions that I will not have time to talk about. But the first question we wanted to ask is, can we identify expression profile within and between species that are consistent with the action of natural selection on gene regulation?
Can I ask one more thing about these large numbers? So if you were to take two different humans or two rhesus macaques from, different places, not brother and sister, do you know how many genes would be differentially expressed between the same tissue from those individuals?
Yeah, our study design allows us to do that because we have multiple individuals per species. By now, we also have a lot of data of multiple individuals between human populations, and so we can do that within the same population, across population, and it's many fewer genes that are differentially expressed. In the order, depending on the tissue, of course, some tissues are more susceptible to environmental variants, some are less, but it's in the order of magnitude of about half of what we see between human and chimpanzee.
Okay, so if human chimp is 2,500 are different, then you get 1,200 different between two chimps.
That's the order of magnitude. Yeah. And these numbers, of course, always need to be interpreted in the context of the power to detect this. Because the more individuals you have on two groups that are actually different, for example, two human populations, the more genes you can detect the differentially expressed if they really are, because you have more power. So the effect size might be smaller. So the comparison here needs to be done in a kind of a careful way. So this question is important to us because it really will, it's really in the basis of our investigations. Our gene regulatory patterns under selection, that they're functionally important. Is a lot of this variance that we see between species under selection, or is it just neutral and the result of some noisy process and we can measure it, but it doesn't really matter? I think the answer to that is extremely important for us before we embark on subsequent studies that may cost a lot of money and time to figure out whether these differences are functional. It's very similar to investigations in DNA sequence that try to figure out whether conserved regions, whether regions in the genome other than coding regions, are functionally important. Before we even know the function of these regions, we have so many studies that try to figure out whether there's evidence that they are functionally important, or what's the proportion of sites that are functionally important. And just the talk we heard yesterday dealt with this issue. And in a similar fashion, we would like to find evidence to support our notion that these patterns are important. And so how do we do that? And I guess before I show this slide, let me continue to talk about how we do that. So when you work with mole organisms, and you work on a quantitative trait, and expression levels are quantitative traits, and you ask this question, can I find patterns that are consistent with the action of natural selection? A lot of the time, one uses a null model of no selection, the evolution of gene expression or quantitative trait without selection. And that model involves some estimates of important parameters, such as the mutational input and the generation time and the separation time. And then you can construct an expectation under the null, and when you reject that, hopefully in favor of a model that includes selection, thereby limiting the variance or increasing the variance beyond expectation. Now, we cannot use such a model for primates. We don't have a clue about most of these estimates, and we can't perform actual experiments to measure them. Now, one can suggest, well, some of these processes may be almost universal. Mutation rate seems to be roughly similar between even rodents and humans, so might you be able to take the estimates of mutational input, plug something about the generation time and separation time and use these models? Well, the answer is yes, people have done it. From Dan Hartle lab, people publish papers. When you do that, all gene expression differences between species, primate species, seem to evolve under stabilizing selection. So nothing has enough variance given these estimates to suggest that it evolves neutrally. Now, we might argue about that. To me, it actually intuitively makes sense, but it doesn't help us prioritize those patterns that seem to be more important than others. Perhaps everything evolves under some measure of stabilizing selection. No gene is truly free to change its expression, but there must be some gradients there. Some genes are regulated at the more strict level, and some genes regulated at the less strict levels, and some of these expression patterns we see are more or less important, and we want to go beyond that. And these types of models in primates don't allow us to do it. So we take a very heuristic approach. So there's no model here. And we pretty much rank the genes by empirical observations. And so this is a busy slide, so let me take you through it by just focusing on one panel. What you see here on the y-axis is the relative expression level. And by relative, I mean we decided that human will be zero, and everything is relative to that, and we maintain the difference, of course, so it doesn't really matter what the number is here. This is on fold change, so minus 1 and 1 is a two-fold difference. And then in each panel, you see the results from the 6 humans, 6 chimpanzees, and 6 rhesus samples, and this happens to be for the liver data. And so you see the mean over these 6 individuals and the standard error. And the purpose of our heuristic approach is to rank genes by the summary of the evidence that is consistent, in this case, with the action of stabilizing selection on gene regulation. And so, in our mind, stabilizing selection on gene regulation will result in lack of difference in gene expression between species, as well as very low within species variance, so between individuals within species. And so, even statistically, it's a difficult question to ask, because at best you can construct a model that will, a null model that you will reject when gene expression differences exist between species. And you actually want to throw away these and keep all the genes that do not have gene expression differences between species. But of course, a lot of these just have a lot of variance between individuals, and so you don't have power to detect gene expression differences between species. And so what we came up with is a simple ranking process. We look at all these genes that don't have expression difference, and we rank them based on how little variance they have between individuals and between species. And so we end up with patterns like this. So these are six genes that we chose at random from the, I think, top 1,000 genes in the rank. And what you see here are genes for which expression levels really have not changed between individuals or between species. And I think this is for liver data, yes.
Excuse me, maybe I'm confused. Normally one associates like selection as sort of something that happens that distinguishes between divergence and within species variance. So if, for example, the divergence relative to the variance is bigger or smaller or something like that. So here you treat, are you treating within species variance and cross species like on the same footing or?
We measure them separately, of course. We estimate them as independent effects, but we argue that stabilizing selection on a particular gene regulatory pattern will result in the within species as well as the between species level of expression to be exactly the same. So in the quantitative trait framework, rather than in it's actually pretty similar to a gene on the genome, whereby you cannot allow any non-synonymous variance within the species or between the species. It's just always conserved. It's conserved within the population. It's conserved between different species. You just can't allow polymorphism or divergence here. In quantitative traits, it's probably most often the case because it's really the particular value of the trait that is under stabilizing selection.
I mean, the reason why one does it for sequence comparison that sort of takes out the within species variance rather than the denominator is that there is something like a mutational opportunity, so which is vastly different. So what makes you think that could it be that within a species that the possible range of variance between individuals is constrained for reasons completely different from natural selection?
For example?
I don't know, I mean, it's just, this is like the standard reasoning for sequences. Like, you're saying you're treating it in a very different way.
But even in sequences, the question is of time scales, right? It's the mutational target is the same, but it's the fact that the things may linger in a different time scale, but you will not see them actually reach fixation.
Right, but you notice that something has a sort of increased divergence over polymorphism. So the polymorphism is the denominator. He put them somehow in the numerator. And so this was just the basis of my question.
But maybe this will get clarified if you could explain a little bit what we're looking at. So, you know, what is one in these units? And maybe going back to the previous slide, I mean, there are, so there's just one variance that we're looking at between the samples?
Fold change between samples within species on each thing. And
so we're just looking at the variance on six samples. Right?
So we're looking in each individual bar as the variance over the six samples, and we're looking at the difference in the mean expression level between species on this y-axis. And if you reach one or minus one, that would be a twofold change. These are actually.
And this is relative to what?
This is relative to human, but just by construction. It's
relative to the average of all genes in that species.
The average, no, this is specific for this gene. So
why is it zero by that? Why is it mean zero?
Just by construction.
The green dot it is.
We just construct this level to be zero, and everything else is relative to that level.
And where is the variance of the replicates?
The variance in the replicate is actually taken into account in the actual model. This is actually a ranking that by construction, actually we ended up not doing that. But by construction, what we did is taking the individual between individual variance and dividing that by the technical variance, because we were concerned that they correlate by this variance, the variance over replicate, because we were concerned that they might be correlated. If we can't estimate one better than the other, they might compete. They actually turn out to be not correlated. And so what you see here is just really the individual variance, just the biological variance between individuals.
I guess I can be reasonably confident that the biological variance is greater than the relevance variance between replicates?
Yes.
By a factor of two?
Well, for individual genes, for individual genes, especially the genes for which we choose the variance between individuals to be very low, that ratio will actually be typically small. Globally, when you just look at all biological variance between individuals of the same species and compare it to technical variance, it's about an order of magnitude.
So, a very simplified way to put Michael's question is to say, isn't it a bit of a bold jump to say those genes who change expression least across the species and across individuals within species, those are probably the ones that are the most stabilized in selection? I mean, there might be many reasons why it's not very. Maybe these are just high expressed genes, right? I mean, most of the time, if you look at expression data, you look at the things that are that seem to change least. Those are very high expressed, housekeeping genes that are on at a high level, maybe even saturated on the chip. And so you get the same numbers roughly all the time. So, it seems to me a pretty big jump to say these are then the most selective, right?
So there are many issues here. The first issue is whether there are technical explanations for this. So if genes are highly expressed, but they're expressed at a constant level, I'm not worried about that. For example, housekeeping genes that are highly expressed and expressed at a constant level, we want them to be part of these. We think that they're highly expressed and at the same level because they're regulated very strictly to be housekeeping genes. So that's actually a biological result. However, we're worried about something else. Perhaps they're so highly expressed, not at the same level, that the array is saturated. Or perhaps they're not expressed at all, like Shamil pointed out. And so what you see here is pretty much no signal, which has no variance. And so what we try to do is, or what we do, is restrict our data only to include things that are intermediately expressed, remove the top 10%, remove the bottom 10% or 20%, and see that you still see the same genes, or actually in everything I will tell you, we actually only include these genes. That's number one. Number two, even after you exclude this technical explanation, of course, this signature by itself is not evidence for stabilizing selection. It's consistent with, I think, our expectation for stabilizing selection, but there's no evidence here. More than that, I suggested a ranking. I never told you where we put the cutoff. And I don't think we can put the cutoff. There's no information about when the pattern that is compelling for or consistent with evidence for stabilizing selection stops and become much less compelling. And so I'm not even going to defend the cutoff. What I think is, though, hopefully agreeable to most of you, is that when you rank genes by this pattern, At the top of the list, you enrich for genes whose regulation evolves under stabilizing selection. And at the bottom of the list, there's an under-enrichment for genes like that. Because genes that are very differentially expressed between species are clearly not under stabilizing selection. And genes for which the within species variance is very high are much less likely to be under strong stabilizing selection.
Could you do better than just starting at the top and the bottom? Because there might be some relationship between intensity level and variance that you don't know anything about. And so could you do the same as sort of like an MA plot?
Yeah.
To get a variance that somehow scaled for...
Yeah. We look at that. We looked at these we have not done that because when we looked at this relationship, we don't see variance correlated with any of the other effects that we can think about. For example, intensity or differential expression or a group or a functional group or anything like that. But yeah, this is part of the quality controls we looked at.
So why should the variance of expression between individuals within one species lead you to stabilizing selection? Suppose you find out that the variance within a species is proportional to the number of transcription factors regulating that gene. So would you say genes regulated by many factors are under less selection? There can be many reasons why the variance changes, and selection may be one of them, but this remains to be proven. I don't think that just by itself it provides evidence, ranking or not ranking.
I don't disagree. I don't actually disagree. But these are the patterns that one expects if selection operates. The fact that this pattern can exist even without selection, this is not mutually exclusive. I agree with that. I want to find a pattern that enriches four genes with regulation involved on the stable egg selection, acknowledging the fact that I can't separate other factors. In fact, when I reach the direction of selection, it'll be even a bigger problem. So, but among these, there are patterns that emerge, and everything I will talk about are patterns that emerge, and they're robust to the actual cutoff that you choose. And by that, I don't mean that we chose, of course, every cutoff, but if you take the first percent of genes, or the first 5% of genes, or the first 10% of genes, you still see the same pattern. And one example of this pattern is that there's a very large overlap of genes whose regulations seem to be under stabilizing selection, or where the evidence here is compelling enough, across tissues. And this is intuitively what we expect. And this is, of course, after we remove those genes that we think are not expressed in any of the tissues, and so on and so forth. And this is intuitively what we expect because we believe that a lot of those genes are, for example, housekeeping. A lot of those genes have functions in multiple tissues. And so they are supposed to be under strict regulation in multiple tissues. And this overlap is highly significant in terms of an expectation of just random patterns across tissues. And then we can actually look at pathways. For those of you who kind of have had conversations with me in the past, you know that I don't like showing tables of geocategories or pathways that are enriched in a particular group of genes that you define in a certain way. I typically don't trust them. I don't think that they're easy to interpret. But the signature we see here is overwhelming, and it is not dependent on any way you cut the data. And it doesn't matter which database you use. You can use a manually curated database and look at genes one at a time if you only take the first, say, 1,000 genes. You still see the same. And what you see here is that housekeeping genes, metabolic genes, and transcription factors are always highly represented. And it doesn't matter which tissue you look at. It doesn't matter whether you look at all the tissues together at an end or at an or. It's always, these three groups are always extremely highly represented among genes that we think are enriched with genes with regulation evolved under stabilizing selection. That's an important signature for us. It makes sense biologically to us, and it suggests to us individual pathway we can start working on that whose regulation is functionally important. Yeah.
So many of those make perfect sense. But transcription factors, can you just say something about why transcription factors would be understood in this category?
Let me get back to it. Transitive factors are important for us. Let me get back to it. If I forget to relate it to stable line selection, remind me. The flip side of these patterns are the patterns that are consistent with directional selection. And I actually probably should have shown it for stable line. This is just a stepwise statistic that we use in order to rank these. And so it's just in a log likelihood framework under the linear model where we just reject or accept, that is retain, not really accept, right? Reject or retain genes based on their patterns and then rank them based on their variance. And so in a very similar way, the patterns that we rank here are genes whose expression levels within and between species are relatively constant in the non-human primates, and then where we find an exclusive elevation or reduction in expression level only in humans, while maintaining low within species variance. And this, if you had some problems with the stabilizing selection patterns, this is slightly worse in terms of the interpretation for various reasons. First, the issue here is that we can't really separate between. If you grant me that this pattern indicates constraint, we can't really separate relaxation of constraint on the human lineage from actual directional selection. So even if we agreed that this is stabilizing selection, then why am I claiming that this is directional selection rather than a simple relaxation of constraint that released the expression level of this gene to change freely? Well, we think we enrich for stable, and I acknowledge this is a problem. We think that we enrich mostly for genes under directional selection rather than under relaxation of constraint by conditioning on low within species variance. So this goes back to my expectation that low within species variance, it does tell you something about selection. If there's directional selection to shift the mean of a quantitative trait to a new advantageous mean, mostly it will accompany, this process will be accompanied by still maintaining a low within species variance around this mean, because that's where selection is going. A simple relaxation of constraint means that the mean can change to any value, but also you don't restrict the variance because it's relaxed. And so we think that this pattern is actually enriching for more cases of directional selection. But perhaps even a more important problem, and this is where I fully agree, is how do you know this is selection? There are many processes that can cause this pattern. Chief among these are simple differences in environment. I don't think that any of these chimps or rhesus macaques drank coffee before the car accident that caused the liver to end up in my freezer. Perhaps all the humans drank coffee, and so what we see here is a simple shift in gene expression due to environmental effects that are shared for all individuals within species and different for individuals across species. We fully acknowledge that possibility, as well as the fact, said fact, that we cannot deconfound those genetic and environmental factors in primates. That's just a problem for us. Those patterns might be caused by either genetic or environmental factors. Nevertheless, once again, using the same rationale, when we rank these genes, cannot defend the cutoff. On the top, we enrich for genes under directional selection. At the bottom, there might be many fewer of them. And the question is, can we still play with these cutoffs and find patterns that are extremely robust to whatever cutoff we suggest? Can we remove genes at random and still find patterns that are robust to whatever group of genes we look for? And the answer is yes. And I'm only talking about these patterns that I believe are robust. One of them is the gratifying observation that the overlap of genes whose regulation evolves under directional selection, or where it's likely under directional selection, across tissues is much, much smaller than what we observe for stabilizing selection. This is gratifying and important because we have a notion that adaptive evolution through gene regulation is a good idea, because unlike in protein sequences where one change might affect everything the protein does wherever it does it, namely in multiple tissues in multiple developmental stages, so temporally and spatially, a change in expression can be very specific only in the liver. Whatever this gene is doing in the kidney doesn't matter. We're not affecting it. We're just affecting the expression level of this gene in the liver. And so it's easier perhaps to work through evolution by changing gene regulation because you suffer from fewer pleiotropic deleterious effects. This is a notion that is, this observation is consistent with, because unlike stable latent selection, where we saw huge overlap between tissues, here, when we look at directional selection, the overlap is much, much smaller. The other observation is that there are a couple of things that remain extremely consistent regardless of how we look at those genes. Transcription factor and metabolic pathways are under directional selection as well.
I mean, these p-values are now really at the level that I would say it's really a stretch. These go categories.
Okay, so you're right. I should say something about this analysis. So we had a pilot product that I didn't mention. It was published in 2006, where we only used 1,000 genes in the same species. There were different individuals on a different platform. And that was the first time we saw transcription factor and metabolic pathways, as well as housekeeping genes in the previous analysis, popping up. So this time, the first analysis we performed was a Bayesian in nature. We didn't have a prior, but we only used these groups of genes. And we did not use, at the beginning, actually a geo functional analysis. We used papers that actually categorized annotated which genes are transcription factor and which genes are in metabolic pathways. And then these p-values are strictly the p-values we gave when we asked just one question about one geocategory that is about transcription factor and then one geocategory about metabolic genes. And those are the p-values I show you here. Subsequent to that, partially in order to validate our approach and see that our prowess makes sense, we performed a global geoanalysis using one of the tools, David. And with much smaller p-values, transcription factor and metabolic genes were the first two categories that came up. I would have probably been happy if they were the first top 10, but they were really the first two. So any way you slice the data, you get these two first categories. Regardless of what analysis you perform. And once again, these things came up in those analysis of only 1,000 genes. So why do I think it's interesting? Well, transcription factors, changing a transcription factor obviously can have, I'm realizing I'm going to argue it both ways, but I think in transcription factors it makes sense. Changing a transcription factor can have a huge effect on gene regulation, obviously, because the change can propagate in the entire regulatory network. And we see this, for example, in knockdown studies. When we knock down a gene in metabolic pathway in a liver cell line, a couple hundred genes are differentially expressed. Several hundred genes are differentially expressed. When we knock down a transcription factor that is important in liver cell line, 25 to 50% of the genes finally are differentially expressed. It just propagates through the entire network. And so in that sense, transcription factor regulation needs to be under very tight control. And so whether it's stabilizing selection or directional selection, they're always overrepresented under very tight control. So why is it represented in directional selection? Well, because on the other side of this coin, a change in transcription factor is a very effective way to change the entire regulatory pathway. It's still under very tight regulatory control, but it shifts the mean to a new and better mean for the species. And so we think these are very interesting. They're also very interesting to follow up. And after the break, I'll tell you about one story where we follow up one of these. Metabolic genes are extremely interesting because, and this is my personal opinion, but I think among many obvious differences between humans and other primates, both in lifestyle as well as morphology and so on. One that is very easy to study, or relatively easy to study and very easy to understand, is the huge shift in diet. Many non-human primates share more or less similar diet, and we have a very different diet. Now, of course, this is also environmental. It's not just going to cause genetic differences, but it's a very important difference. And the fact that we see always this huge enrichment of metabolic genes evolve under directional selection, I think, is encouraging and is something to study. I'm going to skip this. This is just another type of analysis using a very different tool, Ingenuity, that also picks up all these metabolic pathways.
So in other tissues like lung or brain, would you also find metabolic genes?
I don't know about the, I don't have the data for the lung yet or the lymphocytes. That's the next thing that's going to come online. In the heart, there are fewer metabolic pathways that show up than of course in the liver and the kidney. And I don't work with brain. So one of the things I didn't mention about these tissues we choose to work with is that the cellular composition is very, very, well, it's as homogeneous as you can find in the human body or in primates' bodies, with livers being the best case scenario because 70% of cells are hepatocyte, kidney in the cortex and heart in the muscle are being relatively homogeneous. And so it eliminates the potential for getting samples that are consistently have different cellular composition between species, which is not going to be the case in the brain. The brain is slightly more complicated because there are hundreds of different neurons. I'll finish this section by just going through what ended up being the title of this talk, and I think the most important observations, at least for us, about tissue-specific selection on gene regulation. This is where we wanted to take this. This is why we did it in multiple tissues. We wanted to figure out whether we can find support for that notion that evolution through gene regulation is easier because you can really select for different patterns in different tissues, so avoiding these multiple pleiotrophic deleterious effects. And the way we came up with is trying to find evidence for difference selection pressures in different tissues across these species. And one may argue, perhaps not very convincingly, that when you see these different patterns in different tissues, that's already suggestive of the fact that, as I actually have argued just 10 minutes ago, it's already suggestive of the fact that these observations are consistent with this notion. But of course, lack of evidence is not evidence of absence, and in particular in our case where I also argued that, I cannot defend these cutoffs, and so what I call understabilizing selection does not mean that everything else is not. So we wanted to be very conservative and really look at different selection pressures in different tissues. And this is an even busier slide than the last one, so I'll again take it slowly using one panel. What you see at the top panel are the normalized raw absolute values of all the probes that we have on the array for that gene. So all the probes from human, all the probes from liver, all the probes from kidney, all the probes for heart for human on that gene. And I only put it here so you can see that the patterns that I'm going to describe are not a result of an outlier probe or alternative splicing where a group of probes separated from the rest. It's really a consistent pattern. So this is just for you to observe that it's really a consistent pattern. This is really where I want you to focus. This is the same structure on the y-axis as the previous slide. So it's a relative expression level. The numbers don't really matter except they're in log scale. So it's a relative expression level. But here's the difference. We look here this time at all the three tissues in the three species. And so focus for a moment on this, on the expression levels in the human heart, the chimpanzee heart, and the rhesus heart. These resemble the expression pattern between species and within individuals, within species, that I argued is consistent with the action of stabilizing selection. And in fact, this gene is ranked very high among the independent analysis in the heart for genes under stabilizing selection. This is the same pattern that we see in the human kidney, chimpanzee kidney, and the rhesus kidney. Also, the expression pattern there is also consistent with stabilizing selection. But it's a very different pattern that we see in the liver. The human liver is expression level is exclusively elevated compared to the chimpanzee and rhesus. And this is the pattern that I argued is consistent with directional selection. And so what we see here is one gene for which the expression patterns are consistent with the action of stabilizing selection in heart and kidney, but are consistent with the action of directional selection in the human liver. And any way you cut the data, you find an appreciable number of genes that have this compelling evidence, again, the cutoffs can change, for different selection pressure in the different tissues. So the direction of selection here would be in the liver, in the kidney here, and in the heart here. And so I think this is, well, obviously far from perfect and perhaps not entirely satisfying, almost the best we can do when we actually work with primate tissues and samples. And I think these observations are consistent with that notion that adaptive evolution through gene regulation is important and has these advantages of being specific. And seeing all this, I think we were ready to proceed and try to figure out what specific pathways really evolve under, really have been remodeled in human evolution. We have two other observations that are consistent with this, provide support for the same notion. One of them is coding region, the correlation of coding regions evolution with directional and stabilizing selection. So these are cumulative plots that show that when genes are under stabilizing on directional selection, their DNDS is actually lower. And once again, this makes sense to us. You have an important gene, you can't really freely change its coding region. Most of mutation, non-synonymous mutation on this gene would be deleterious, but you can still play with its regulatory level in one or more tissues. And similarly, and this has been shown before, this is not an original observation, when genes have functions in more tissues, they are under greater constraint. Typically, people just look at expression breadth and show a correlation between expression breadth and constraint. Here we, I think, refine this analysis slightly because we actually look at constraint on expression level in this tissue, and this is the way we classify whether it's important or not. And when you are under constraint in three tissues, you are under more constraint than if you're under more constraint at the protein coding level than if your regulation is under constraint only one tissue. So I think I'll finish this part with a question, and then we'll take a little break, and I'll tell you about the second part of this presentation.
So again, a question regarding the variances in expression levels within species. I mean, some of it is certainly environmental differences, right? So can we kind of quantify the heritability of these variances by looking at relatives, close relatives? They vary the same way.
Absolutely.
Different genes too.
Absolutely. And I think Vivian Chang was the first to do that in, if I recall correctly, 2001, a classic paper showing how gene expression differences between twins are smaller on average and between brothers are smaller on average and between unrelated individuals, and actually looked at heritability of gene expression in families. This was the basis for the entire field of expression quantitative trait loci mapping that relies on the fact that there's a heritable genetic, significant heritable genetic component for gene expression. This is clearly something that can be done and is done. In this context, we don't have that.
But does it vary between genes? I mean,
of course.
Maybe the genes with very small variants are actually just the most heritable ones.
We did not correlate our data. So all the data that exists in human on heritability is actually in cell lines, in LCLs. And so it did not make a lot of sense to correlate that with our data. But hopefully when data of that nature will come for livers and kidneys, or when in a couple of months when we'll have our own data on LCLs, we'll go back. That's exactly, that intuition is exactly, or we agree with that intuition very much.
So were all the studies on EQTLs and expression level heritability and comparison of population, is it GM cell lines or is it what kind of cell type is it?
It's lymphocytes.
It's all in lymphocytes. So people didn't know that number.
Well, so Eric Schatt did it also in liver, and there are a couple of studies, I'm sorry, I forget the name, that did it in adipose tissues and fibroblasts. But those are smaller studies, and there's nothing else so far.
Can you get a cell line out of hepatocytes, or they had volunteers for biopsies?
You can get cell lines from that. The thing is, for the lymphocyte cell lines, of course, this is the HapMap resource.
For lymphocytes.
You could, yes, but you know, depending on what your purpose, you might argue that these studies are best done in primary tissues, not really in cell lines. So why actually? I mean, these are HapMap cell lines, and everything is going to be studied on them, and it makes sense to do that as well on them. But if you're interested really in regulatory mechanisms, you might want to do it in primary tissues, and I think that's what Eric Schatz did, and I think that's what people do more and more when they manage to collect these tissues. But obviously, it takes more time. It's more difficult than working with the HapMap cell lines. So shall we take a break and? The survivors of the first part, I will tell you about a more focused exploration of one of these transcription factors that we believe evolved under the direction of selection in regulatory pattern, and how we try to track down what pathways might be influenced by this change in gene expression level. And this one is FOXO1A, and you can see here a pattern. It's the same structure of plots that I've been showing you all along. You might notice there's one more species here, it's the orangutan. And it is exclusively elevated in humans compared to all the non-human primates in a fashion that is consistent with the action of directional selection to elevate its expression in humans.
This is one of the genes which is under directional selection.
Which we believe is under directional selection exclusively in the human lineage.
You're not going to look at the binding sites or the regulatory region of one of those genes. You're going to take one of those transcription factors and see what it affects.
Exactly.
So you've never looked at the binding sites or something regulatory region?
No, we actually have, and we have nice reported gene assays showing, we talked about selection, we talked about the actual cis-regulatory elements that change and track them down using empirical approaches. For whatever reason, I chose not to actually talk about it. It was published more than a year ago. And
do you see signature of selection at that level?
We have not done this with this new collection of genes. With the previous collection of genes, we did not see signature. We did not see clear signature of selection in the regulatory region. We were able to track down some of the cis regulatory elements that changed, but we didn't find evidence for positive selection at the nucleotide level.
But I mean, and you can show that those cis regulatory changes are actually responsible for the change in expression?
No, I can show that these cis regulatory changes in this lineage cause a shift in expression that is consistent in its direction to the expression change we see from the array, and of course all of these are validated using RT-PCRs and so on. But it's very difficult to compare the magnitudes because there are always different technologies, and it's impossible to exclude that there are other interacting changes. So the extent what you can say is that here's one change that contributes to this difference, and when you remove this change, you don't see this difference anymore. But you can't say anything beyond that.
You're doing this somehow in some cell lines?
You do it with reported gene assays, yeah, in cell lines. In cell lines derived from the same tissues that you worked with originally. Yeah, not the same individual tissues, same tissues. So back to FOXO. This is a transcription factor, the target of the IGF insulin pathway. It's extremely well studied. Because, of course, the IGF insulin pathway is extremely important in human diseases. And what has been mainly the focus of a lot of research group was the effect that differences in regulation of FOXO have on lifespan. So I'm sure you all heard that caloric restriction affects lifespan. And it turns out that one of the effects of caloric restriction that is tied to the increased lifespan is the upregulation of FOXO. And we would like to know what are the target genes that are might be affected by the upregulation of FOXO specifically in humans. And so the way we did that was by, and we do it now for a larger collection of transcription factors.
There was a similar discussion with Sergey Newton last week. Say, what makes me a little uncomfortable with FOXO is that the way FOXO is being regulated, not say, the idea is that transcription level is probably roughly constant, but because of its correlation event, it's being transported out of nucleus and in the nucleus in response to all this cascade of kinases that downstream of insulin receptor. So you would think that the major regulation mode of FOXO is not expression level at the level of mRNA. And you do not obviously see a relocalization of FOXO between nucleus and cytoplasm. So how this is playing in the picture? Because people are studying, and Sergey also studied this expression level of FOXO. So is it actually biologically relevant? Because like the simple idea of FOXO is that mRNA level is basically kept constant.
So the messenger RNA level actually changes. So in Colleen Murphy's and studies and in other studies on in C. elegans, the messenger RNA load actually changes. But I people made this comment to me that obviously the localization also changes and the phosphorylation changes. And I am not an expert and do not have information regarding the relative importance of the different mechanisms. I appreciate the comment, yeah. In order to track down the direct regulatory targets of FOXO, we use a combination of empirical approaches. First, the chip, the chromatin immunoprecipitation, and then the knockdown. Now, each of these can't really give you an answer about which are the direct targets, but a combination of these gives you a very strong case. The chip is, of course, the isolation or enrichment of chromatin that is bound by the transcription factor using antibodies against the transcription factor, and then somehow assaying the enriched chromatin. And in this picture, I show you a microarray to do that, but we can do it in PCR. You can do that using sequencing. And what it gives you are, best case scenario, all the regulatory regions that are bound by these transcription factors. And then if you know, for example, if these regulatory regions are promoters, you know which are the target genes that might be regulated by this. But of course, there's a lot of false positives, and there's a lot of perhaps regions in the genome where transcription factor rests, but they don't really have regulatory activity. And so we combine that or intersect that with a study of all the genes that are differentially expressed when you knock down FOXO. When you perform a knockdown of a transcription factor, thousands of genes are differentially expressed. Only a fraction of them are direct targets. The rest are secondary targets or just responding to the overall change in phenotype in the cell line. But now we can clearly see which one of them are actually have the transcription factor in their regulatory elements. And so it builds a strong circumstantial case that this gene is being regulated by this transcription factor. And so we did that. This is just a picture that indicates that the knockdown was successful. This is a knockdown at the RNA level. This is the knockdown at the protein level. And we looked at all the genes that change their expression following the knockdown. So obviously, so I'm showing you a volcano plot with the p-value or FDR and the log 2-fold change. So all these are reduced expression when FOXO was knocked down, and all these have increased expression when FOXO was knocked down. Obviously, FOXO was reduced in its expression in its knockdown. That's obvious. And you can see about half the genes have changed their expression. Now, you have here eight arrows, and the eight arrows are for the only eight genes that in our investigation we found evidence for binding of FOXO to their promoter. And we only looked at the promoter here, so it's a very narrow view. FOXO might bind to regulatory regions outside of the promoter, and we acknowledge that.
The intersection between the chip and the siRNA is eight genes?
Yeah, I should say this is a small array of only 1,000 genes. This is all being done on the pilot array. So between the 1,000 genes, there are only eight that had the transcription factor binding to their promoter. Yeah. So this is only 1,000 genes. Sorry, I did not mention that. So this is just a picture of the chip when we did the PCR, showing that FOXO actually bound to the promoter of this gene. This is a positive and negative control, and this is a control for the chip itself.
This is liver. This is all liver story.
This is all liver story. Yeah. Yeah, I should have said that. So this is actually a project, remember when I first showed you the picture of fox being under selection, there was another species there, the orangutan. And in the previous study, I only mentioned human, chimpanzee, and rhesus. This is actually a follow-up on the pilot project. The pilot project had four species, had 1,000 genes. It was very similar in structure to everything I told you about, but it was just much smaller. And we actually started a follow-up on one very interesting gene before we performed the major study. So here are the eight genes. And the story I will tell, there are stories about almost any of these genes and the pathway that has changed and how it changed between human and chimpanzee and what phenotype it might underlie. But I will focus just for a couple of minutes and will tell you a story about this gene, TXNIP.
Did you check if those eight genes are also changing in the right way in the expression of human versus the other primates?
Yeah. Seven of them do.
I have another comment. I found in the first part of your talk very convincing, so you understand all the caveats, but you have like very robust observations. So when we go towards individual genes, there's environment, because obviously insulin response pathway in terms of diet differences, because they humans not only drink coffee, they drink coffee with sugar. And
I'll make it robust by the end.
Okay.
I acknowledge the fact that everything I say now seems to connect the dots with very thin lines, but it's because when we have the finding, we'll go back and make sure that it's extremely robust. The finding is the TXNIP. That's the arrow that we really cared about. And the reason we care about is that a lot is known about this gene. TXNIP is thyrodoxin interacting protein. It is a protein inhibitor of thyrodoxin. Thyrodoxin is one of the major regulator of the oxidative response pathway in the cell. And so when TXNIP is upregulated, it inhibits the entire response to oxidative stress. When it's downregulated, the response is more effective. And FOXO is a repressor of TXNIP. So when FOXO is downregulated, as in this knockdown, TXNIP is upregulated. So where does it put us? Now, first of all, these are all the papers that obviously, I mean, you know it if you just look at at the right aisle in the supermarket, oxidative stress is being associated with aging. And if we don't believe it as scientists, at least there are many drug companies that made millions out of this notion. And so really the only thing we added to this picture is this line, this, as I said, thin line. The fact that FOXO is a transcriptional inhibitor of TXNIP, and from there on everything was figured out by other people. And why do we think it's important? First of all, because of this connection between FOXO and response to oxidative stress and lifespan. That has been known before, but no one pointed out what are the intermediate steps, why it can regulate oxidative stress. And I think now we understand that it's through TXNIP. Well, now we want to try to make this robust because this is now a phenotype and we can study this phenotype. In fact, this is such a lucky phenotype because you can study it in cell lines even with human and chimpanzee. You can use actual experiment to check whether this is correct or not. And so just before we starting with this expensive experiment, we wanted to make sure this is a real observation. And so the first thing we did is making the case, this case for the regulation, the direct interaction, slightly stronger. I told you, I think it's a strong circumstantial case. Now we try to do some biology with it or provide direct evidence. And we do that by using reported gene assays in the same cell lines, whereby we mutate the FOXO binding site. So the FOXO binding site in the promoter is known. We now found that it's functional. And so now we compare the activity of promoter with the binding site to the one without the binding site. And we have a clear expectation because we know the direction. We know FOXO is a repressor of TXNIP. And so when we do that, we find exactly what we expected. The mutated promoter has higher activity. Now, what I'm not going to show you, because that's recent and I forgot to include it on the slide, is that I gave this talk in Canada and someone gave me the obvious comment that we didn't think about because we made a mistake, that this actually doesn't mean that we just mutated the binding site. We might actually introduce here a new binding site. So this result cannot be taken as a clear indication that FOXO was the repressor. It might be a different binding site for a different transcription factor we introduced. So we repeated this in the same cell line when we knocked out transcription factor FOXO. So if we still see this binding, it's because something else was binding there. If we don't see this difference, it's because really it was FOXO1. And we did that, and this difference disappeared. So I think now we built a very strong case that TXNIP is a direct regulator regulated by FOXO. And then the question that now jumps out immediately is, okay, is TXNIP really differentially expressed between human and chimpanzee? In fact, at the time, it was not on our small microarray of only 1,000 genes, so we had to do that. This is the picture from liver. The expression is much higher in chimpanzee, suggesting again that the oxidative response stress of chimpanzee is lower. And then we see the same picture in every tissue we have in the lab. So we see it, basically, we try it, I think, in 7 or 8 tissues. TXNIP is always highly expressed in chimpanzees compared to human. So it suggests a phenotype. And, you know, this is a completely made-up story, right? We pretty much know these parts are true now from here to here. We know that TRX also regulates the response to oxidative stress. We now have, though, an hypothesis that it really has something to do with lifespan. There's very well-documented evidence that humans live longer than chimpanzees.
It's like aging story is fascinating, but any indication in genetic studies of diabetes of this genes? For FOXO, obviously, is one of the genes people are talking about. What about this gene?
TXNIP?
TXNIP.
In, and I don't know in diabetes, but in mice, caloric restriction shows this. I mean, this comes up in the microarray analysis. So I'm just going to finish by saying we trust this interaction. We don't know whether it is or it's not related to the phenotype, but we trust this interaction. But now, because we mapped and of course, I'm not going to suggest that this is the reason FOXO was under or not under selection. It's we can't go backwards and claim that this is the what caused selection of FOXO. But I think it's one of the possible consequences of selection on FOXO, or at least differential expression in FOXO between the species. And so we want to test that rigorously. And we have this system that is easy to implement. And this is always our goal when we work in primates. We look for those phenotypes that we actually can study. There's so much we cannot. Oxidative stress is very easy to study using simple, for example, hydrogen peroxide and looking at survival curves and then knocking down TXNIP, knocking down FOXO, comparing between species, and so on and so forth. So I think I'll finish with this example. What you will not hear about, at least in this forum, is another study very much along the same lines with P53. P53, of course, the famous molecule that is involved or associated with so many cancers. It's different between human and chimpanzee. It also has a common polymorphism in humans, and we wanted to figure out how it affects the regulatory networks. We use similar approaches, but this time we combine the comparison. Everything I told you about FOXO was only in humans. Now we combine these approaches or perform these approaches in more than one species, and it really allows us to look at the regulatory mechanisms that are responsible for the change. If there's a change in the cis or the trans, in one of them or in both, we can really distinguish between different mechanisms of evolution. And that story on P53 really highlights some genes that are differentially expressed between or differentially regulated between different versions of the protein. And finally, as I said, I at least included this slide, and we can talk about it later, on the use of new high-throughput sequencing technologies for RNA expression characterizations. I think they work very well. I mean, more people now start using them and published similar results. And I imagine in a year, 2 or 3, microarrays, at least for global gene expression, will be used much less frequently. So I'll finish here.
I have one comment, but maybe maybe you can answer. I find it totally fascinating, but you came from evolutionary angle, but the discovery you've made in terms of FOXO is just standard genomics. So there are so many people working on diabetes aging and the insulin pathway. So do you have any explanation why it took someone to come from evolutionary angle to find this? Like this whole huge community, because all techniques are available generally, and like, was there any key in finding this human-chimp differences which help?
I don't think so. I don't think we can take credit for the approach. My lab is at the forefront of these technologies, and we use chip and knockdowns. The combination of the chip and knockdown, we were one of the first lab to do that. Not because we have this great insight, just because we are at the forefront, so we used that when it became available. So I don't think there were actually many studies. There aren't still many studies of global chips and global knockdown with FOXO to survey and to figure out whether this is this was the case or not. So we happened to be first by luck, not because we came from the evolutionary perspective. I think what we see on P53 is perhaps more the insight we see in P53, which I think a lot of it hopefully will be appreciated by the community to study P53 from the cancer angle. I think a lot of that is actually something we bring to the table because of our interest in evolution. I think that's a better, perhaps a better case of that.
So this story was just pure.